My name is Steve. I'm an alcoholic.
Hey, Steve.
My home group is the Steppin' Up group in Culpeper. My sobriety date is May 22nd, 1984. I hadn't been asked to speak for about 10 years, and I got two requests this month, so I think it's time. What it was like, what happened, and what it's like now. My story is a story of alcoholism intertwined with mental problems, psychiatric problems. So that some of the stuff that I'm going to talk about is probably a little difficult for me, and some of it may be a little cryptic, but I'll do the best I can to be honest, open, and willing. Or who, as my sponsor says, first you got to be willing, then you got to be honest, then you can be open. But I grew up in an alcoholic home. My grandfather was a first-generation Irishman. His parents were from Ireland. He was an alcoholic, and he got sober. And I don't know whether it might have been in early AA. I don't know. I did go to a club in my hometown and talk to some of the old-timers when I was first sober, and they recognized his name. So it may be that he was in the program in the 40s, in the early 40s. And we never saw him drink until he took a sip of champagne at my sister's wedding, and Grandma went nuts. And we said, "What's wrong with Grandma? What's wrong with Grandma?" Well, I got an AA, and I figured out what's wrong with Grandma. Grandpa was having a sip of champagne. Doesn't mean anything to anybody but an alcoholic or somebody who's lived with an alcoholic. My father was an alcoholic. He was a ne'er-do-well. He couldn't hold a job. My mother was a German, very determined, very worked her butt off, kept the house together, fed us, and we were never on welfare, never took anything, but we were poor. She was a lunch lady, and sometimes she'd bring home milk from the tables that she'd pour back in and boil, and then we'd have to drink it. And powdered milk was even worse than that, so we preferred the boiled milk to the powdered milk. And they basically hated each other. They lived in the same house, but lived separately, very tiny house with seven of us, basically four rooms in the first floor and then the attic where the boys slept. And they were never in the same room. My father walled off a little cell in the basement that had a window, and he covered the window and locked it when he was gone. But when he was home, he was there. So they literally were never in the same room at the same time. And that atmosphere, I'm the middle child. My sister allied with my dad. My older brother allied with my mother. I was the third kid, and I just sort of disappeared. I made myself scarce. When I learned to read, that was my very first addiction. Actually, it was a beneficial one. I escaped into books. I was one of these people who went to the library, one of these kids, a real nerd, and brought home a stack of books and read anything that I could get my hands on. I got caught reading the phone book once and never lived that one down with my siblings, you know. But it was that was beneficial because, I mean, it gave me just reams of information. I mean, it's like a huge database that I've drawn on my entire life, and so it's served me well. My early memories, I really don't remember much about home life until I was in third or fourth grade or fourth or fifth grade. So those early years are just sort of a blank to me. I have some scattered memories, but people would have to physically come and take the book out of my hands to get my attention. And so anyway, I was a nerd. And then puberty hit. Before puberty, I had my first drink. My first blackout was all at the same time. I was about 10 years old and got a door prize at a church festival of a quart of Mogan David wine. And the guy gave it to me and he says, "Now you take that back to your parents." And I said, "Yes, sir." And I took it right out to the playground. And I think I drank the whole thing. I don't know. But I got home and staggered through the living room and started falling, passing out in the bathroom and puking on the floor at the same time. So that's how my drinking started, and it continued. I didn't really start drinking until I was 18, but that was a forerunner. That was pretty much the pattern later on too. I was raised a Catholic. My mother was the housekeeper at the church. Oh my God, I got to get going here. I got involved with the priests there, and they were not pedophiles. They were alcoholics, and I did drink with them. So they taught me to drink, among other things. But one of them was the most brilliant man that I've known in my life. He was an Irishman from Chicago. His name was Fogarty, Charlie Fogarty. He was a wonderful preacher. He could improvise classical music on the piano. He was the best preacher that I've ever heard in my life. He's just a brilliant, brilliant man. And a total alcoholic. And drank himself out of the priesthood, ended up on Skid Row in San Francisco, and got sober a year before he died, and then he died of pancreatic cancer. And I came into the program 3 months after he died, and I think that there's a spiritual connection there. But being exposed to those priests, you know, I said to myself, I want to be a priest. So I went away to a boarding school on a full scholarship. We couldn't have afforded that. But I learned later it was a way to escape my house. And I certainly wasn't priestly material, and they told me that in the middle of my junior year. But let me stay. They gave me they continued my scholarship and let me stay in the non-seminary part of the school, boarding school. And it was a great experience for me, because the monks there were well educated and caring and nice. They were a good group. So at about age 13, well, let me see, in 1954. So I was 13 years old. I fell in love with Anne, who was a wonderful girl, and that brought on my psychiatric symptoms. I was totally in love with this girl and totally unable to express any of it, and I just was in, those years are awful anyway, but with the background I had of relationships, that was, and I said later to my psychiatrist, it's like if those two, my mother and father, had come together in a room, it would be like an atomic reaction. There'd be two masses of uranium together. You know, it would have been the end of the world, I thought. That was what I was brought up with. So I didn't sleep. I was... I went to see the guy who I considered the real spiritual guru there. He was later abbot. And went to his room at 8 o'clock one night after study hall and talked for 2 or 3 hours without stopping. And I'm sure I made no sense at all. And he said, "I'm sorry, I can't help you." I graduated from that school. I'm not very close to the top of the class, There were a lot of very smart guys in that school. I was admitted to the University of Chicago, but I didn't go. I knew that I wouldn't be able to cut it there. It was just too beyond me to be able to deal with that. So I enrolled in the University of Illinois, but my first summer job was at the brewery, Pabst Brewery, throwing cases of beer for 8 hours and drinking with all the other alcoholic young guys who worked there. And I soon dropped out of college because, you know, I didn't have any money to drink. I had to work to drink, and there was no money to drink at all. So college had to go, of course. And I did that for 6 years. At one point, I came out of the blackout, in the backseat of a police car in handcuffs, and not knowing why I was there. I looked around, and I was in the left lane, and the cop was in the right lane. It was 2 a.m. in the strip joint district of my hometown, and it forced him off the road into a storefront because I just turned in front of him in a blackout. And I was charged with improper lane usage and fined $35 after spending the night in jail. But in 1964, I got a notice from my draft board that I was number one for the draft. It was the first big draft for the build-up in Vietnam, and I had a 2S deferment. And anyway, I needed a geographic cure, so I joined the Army for 4 years, went to Army Language School, went to Berlin for 2 years, worked in Fort Meade for a year. And I got married in Monterey the first year I was in the Army to a woman that I had known for about 6 weeks. You know, and it was time for another geographic cure because I'd come out of another blackout in the back seat of a police car in Monterey with me in the car, a line of cops, and then an angry crowd on the other side, and I didn't know why I was there. And that was Friday night. They kept me in the drunk tank all weekend for 3 days with 30 or 40 other guys. And then I learned in court that I had tried to start a riot. I'm a little guy, but I got a big mouth. So getting married changed my pattern of drinking. We had kids. I went to law school. Went in the Army, got into law school, did well in law school. I didn't drink much in law school. And then I got a job at the Justice Department in Washington, D.C. So we moved here, and they expected me to be a grown-up to actually work cases and to be in charge of things, you know, from the day one. They expect you to be able to do that. It threw me into, I got sober 12 years after I started at Justice. For the first 12 years, it was nothing but misery for me. I was more and more depressed, more and more angry, grandiose, self-pitying, just an emotional stew of those negative emotions. I figured anger was my motive force. I was angry all the time. I'd jump out in traffic to, you know, when the walk light first shine in D.C., I'd jump out in front of cars that were coming through the intersection. So I had to ride away, and by God, I've got to do it. You know, that'd be a good argument. Every noon, you know, you can do that every day, several times. Little guy like me, little guy. One time I did it to some ATF agents who flashed their badges at me, and I flashed my credential back at them and walked away. But I never got in a physical fight. You know, I just ran my mouth a lot. There was some sort of wisdom involved there that kept me alive. But so my first marriage fell apart. My wife got tired of my anger. I was throwing things. I do remember I had my hands around her throat once. I mean, it was that angry. And I had no clue. I've always been an outsider. I had no conception of how people related to each other as equals or even as intimates. I was not able to be intimate. So we got divorced, and I got remarried to a lady who drank a bottle of wine a night, and stayed married to her altogether about 15 years. I married her when I, 4 or 5 years before I got sober, and we got divorced 4 or 5 years after I got sober. While I was at Justice, I went to see a psychiatrist, and I saw him for 3 years. I talked about all my problems, about how things were horrible, I never talked about alcohol, ever. You know, any of the scrapes I got into, because I was losing cars and, you know, doing that kind of stuff. What I wanted from the psychiatrist was, you know, this some kind of resolution about this isolation that I had. Alcohol was my solution to my problems, and I'd be goddamned if I was going to put that in danger. It was all unconscious, all unconscious. I was there trying to get better. I just went 3 years, two or three times, twice a week for 3 years, spent $75,000 of the insurance company's money. That was cheap then, not now. But his diagnosis was schizoid character or personality disorder. And what that is basically just a description of what I was. I couldn't relate to people, especially women. Not that I'm gay, I'm firmly heterosexual, but it was the inability to be emotionally and intellectually intimate. The personality disorder, I did some reading outside. I don't think you're supposed to do that with psychiatrists, but I was trying to figure out, you know, what was up here. And basically everything I read was that, you know, untreatable. In other words, you know, you're disordered, and then you're going to be that way permanently, and that's who you are. You know, I mean, it's part of your identity. So after that attempt to get better, I quit smoking. I started bicycling, gotten all healthy. And at work, I would go up and down. At times, I did just enough not to get fired. If I had been in any other job in the legal field, in the private sector, I would have been history, you know. But the government is just too much trouble to fire somebody. And I had good friends who would step in when I needed it and help me out. And I'm grateful that I persisted there. At some point, you know, I knew from the very beginning of my drinking that I was an alcoholic. My best friend and drinking buddy, at that time when I was 19 or 20, worked at a liquor store, and I walked in and they had their beer cozies sitting there, and I had never seen one of those before. And I said, "What's that for?" And he says, "That's for other people. That's to keep their beer cold. You know, they don't drink like you and I." And I said to myself, "You know, I am an alcoholic," and I knew it. But alcoholics drank. That's what we did. Besides a brewery, I worked in a distillery, I worked in a winery, I was a bartender, among other things. In 1984, I decided what I needed to do was get my drinking under control. You know, so I went into a treatment program at Arlington Hospital, outpatient treatment program. It only ran 2 months, but I traveled so much that you know, every time I missed a meeting, I'd have to make it up. So it went on for 6 months for me. But I, you know, my last drink was in a warm old Milwaukee on a Wednesday afternoon before I went in there. I was detoxing myself. I started with a 12-pack and worked down to one. I went in there with the conviction that somehow I could get a handle on the drinking, you know, and early in sobriety, there was a guy in a meeting who I went to who had an insulin pump. And I said to myself, I need an alcohol pump. That's all I need. That's the answer, you know. You know, you determine what the blood, that blood level is, you know, the magic moment, you know. We all know what that magic moment is. And why not? But it couldn't have a dial on it because I'd just keep turning it up, I'm sure. You know? So it wouldn't work. But they made us go to AA. And I grudgingly listened. I went to AA meetings almost exclusively in downtown D.C. on my lunch hour. And there were some wonderful people in those meetings. And my first sponsor put his name and number in front of me at a meeting and said, give me a call because, you know, I was complaining about my cases and so on. Well, as it turned out, he worked at Justice too, and he worked in a different division, but two floors up from me. So my sponsor was available by elevator to me, you know, which was wonderful. But those noon meetings had drawbacks in that those people were only there during the day and, you know, went out every which way at night. And there was just none of the social connections in AA that I have here. I gradually, I admitted to myself gradually that... you know, I couldn't drink anymore, but I had that reservation. If I get the death sentence, if I get the heart attack, you know, or cancer would be better because that would give me 3 or 6 months, you know. I'd go out and get drunk and use all those drugs I'd avoided, you know, and just stay screwed up, and wouldn't that be wonderful? And there was a meeting sometime in the early sobriety, you know, first year or sometime, but some months into my sobriety, on reservations. And I said to myself, aha, you know, that's the last thing I would do, because by that time I was a member of AA, and if I'd gotten a death sentence, I'd be right here, you know, I'd be crying on all your shoulders all the time, you know. This is where I get my support, my love. So the steps. The first step was pretty easy for me. I knew my life was unmanageable and I couldn't drink safely. The second and third steps were pure Greek to me. It was just nonsense, you know, because I had to, it was all intellectual. I was a lawyer and you had to think things out. And it's illogical, you know. If you could just turn your problems over to God and have him take care of them, why couldn't I just continue to drink and do that? I mean, why wouldn't that work, you know? That's the kind of shit that was going through my brain. The other thing I was going to do is rewrite the big book, because to get rid of all the golly gee whiz language and, you know, and all the sexism, take all the sexist parts out, you know, and change all the pronouns. I was convinced, you know, that that's what AA needed. And that's how crazy I was. What was happening with me, the thing that I complained about in meetings, I had a whole universe of problems. But the problem that I talked about at meetings was insomnia, because I would go out on travel on my cases. All my cases were out west, and they were all complicated, and I had to go out in the most trivial kinds of things. So I was on the road, you know, 2 or 3 times a month, going out west for 3 or 4 days, sometimes a week or two. And the night before a court appearance, I would start thinking about, well, what if the judge says this? And what if my witness goes south? And what if the opposing counsel does this? And, you know, by 4 a.m., I was just nuts, just nuts. And then I'd fall asleep at 5 and have to get up at 6, you know, and having an hour's sleep, going to court, and you know, it was I was not performing at my maximum by any means. But my sponsor, who was a very wise guy, said, okay, you need to pray about this and use the third step. And I had enough, I don't know, I was humble enough, I was screwed up enough, and I was desperate enough that I would do, I did it. And as we've all experienced, you know, prayer, even if, you know, it's to the fan, whatever, look up, pray, it works. Prayer works. Prayer without faith works. And so that was the aha moment for me. I said, oh, these guys aren't bullshitting. I now see that this stuff can work. And that was my spiritual awakening. It was very gradual. No flashes of light for me, no words from God. And I don't doubt those stories at all, but my story is different. So I worked the steps with my sponsor. But what I did was half-assed. I said to myself, my personality disorder, they now call it a character, it was called a character disorder before, and now it's called a personality disorder, which is a lot softer than a character disorder. I mean, your character is disordered? That's hopeless. I said to myself, you know, this is unpleasant. And I didn't say this to myself, but I'm sure that this was the unconscious process that I went through. That character disorder was for the psychiatrist. It was for medications for depression and, you know, talking therapy, and didn't have anything to do with AA. And didn't come up on my fourth step, didn't come up on my fifth step. Obviously, it didn't work the rest of the steps on it either. I stayed sober, and I had a measure of recovery. Life was certainly better. I was functioning at work. I remarried for a third time to a lady who's in the program, and we've been together more than 25 years. I like to say I've been married 50 years to three different women, but, you know, 10, 15, 25. So, it's thanks to the program that marriage is, you know, a good marriage and has survived. I tootled along. I had an opportunity to move to Rappahannock. We bought a place in Rappahannock in 1999, and I was 58 and had my 30 years in, counting my army. And I was overworked. The kids who we hired were smarter and harder working, and, you know, it was hard to keep up with them. So I said, you know, I think I'll retire. So I retired here. And my meetings fell off. Y'all talk funny down here. You're not from D.C., you know. It was that kind of crap, you know. But I was a meeting in Little Washington on a Thursday night, and I knew enough about AA I knew I had to say something like that, and I did. And Deborah, I don't know if you know Deborah or not, but she's up Flint Hill, and she came to me and said, Steve, you need to get involved in service. And, that was one of the things that I'd heard a million times, but that time it fell on fertile ground. And so I started getting involved in the meetings in Culpeper, leading meetings, doing various service jobs, not high level, but low level, group level stuff. And, started to, you know, so at that time I had about, when I moved here in 99, I had about 15 years. So I I skated for another, until I had 24 years, which would be 2008. And I started asking myself, is this all there is? Is this all there is? There's got to be more than this, because there were just intractable problems, personality problems, relationship problems that I had no clue about how to deal with. And so I went off on a retreat to Karen. It was a weekend retreat in the, I think it's a YMCA camp just above it there for 2 days. And there were 12-step workshops over the 2 days. And so I worked the steps there, and I came away, and I'd sort of gone up there with the idea that it was time for me to work the steps again. So this time, got a new sponsor at 24 years. He's from New York, and I like the New York brand of AA. And I said, I want to work the steps with you. And we did. And this time, I made the connection that a character disorder is also a character defect. And that was a revelation to me after 24 years. Some are slower than others, and I was a slow learner. And it wasn't pleasant. There's a lot of unpleasantness involved in doing that, a lot of embarrassment. I had been living in guilt and shame and anger and resentment for years. But we worked the steps, and I came. What finally came out of it after working all the steps, and I'm still. You know, we're still. We get together. We try to get together every week, face to face for an hour, and then we talk about our week for half an hour, and complain about our lives to each other, and then we. Then we read for a while and discuss whatever it is we're reading. And we've, over the last 8 years, we've read a lot. We've read the big book, The 12 and 12, and AA Comes of Age, and, you know, just lots of books. And I find that's a wonderful mechanism. It's just a great structure for me. Then we co-sponsor each other, and I have sponsees, and a couple of them are sitting in the room here, and we co-sponsor each other, and I think at this stage of all our sobrieties, that's what works. But what came out of that was that I had never felt part of the human race. I had never felt a connection with an intimate connection with people. I was always distant. And it was because I carried guilt and shame and would react from guilt and shame with people. I couldn't be honest with people because it would be shaming. I couldn't be open with people because it would be shaming. What would they think of me if this or that? God forbid if I got in an argument with somebody, you know. That old nuclear bomb would go off. Norman Mailer has a great short story. It's called The Language of Men. And it's a story about guys in the Army. And this guy is doing KP with a bunch of other guys. And he's a misfit like me. And for a minute, he identifies with these people and they identify with him. And then he does something really stupid and he's back, you know. I felt that way. I felt that I was not part of, not worthy of, and not able to relate to people on a human level. And what happened, much to my surprise, was that my character hasn't changed, and my character defect is still there. The personality disorder is still there, but I now can accept myself. And I couldn't love people because I couldn't love myself. And I won't say I love myself now, but I have a little better attitude about myself than I did before. And I can now, accept myself for who I am. This thing started in infancy, and I'm 75, going on 76, and I've been fighting it my entire life. So it's about time to give up that fight and just accept myself for who I am. And I think what's helped immeasurably in that is just getting old. I'm 75. My perspective on just a whole range of things has changed completely. I'm now much more accepting of people and of situations in the world that would have just driven me crazy before. I would have been just distraught. Oh my God. But I have to go back. I left out the part of my spiritual awakening I like to talk about was that, and that I left this out about the third step, and it's important, it's crucial to me, is what the third step did for me was take me out of the center of the universe and put me in my proper place in the universe, which is way out here, and put the higher power in charge. And it made life so much easier. I mean, just absolutely. The stuff that I deal with in retirement is not very complicated, not very hard, and it's not. And that was the miracle of my spiritual awakening. And my wife has a friend who's very wise, and this friend says, that the answer to every problem is more spiritual growth. And that's key for me now because I change, the world changes, people around me change, change is constant, and I have to deal with it, and I can now deal with it. And the other thing is that now that I can accept myself, I can let other people accept me. I'm now open to be loved, which I wasn't before. And that's the hope of the program. That's the beauty of the program. If we continue to spiritually grow, things will change. They may change for the worse. They may change for the better. But they will change. And what I've learned is, with all this shit in my background and being a slow learner and not starting on real work until I was 65, is that things turned out. I mean, they just turn out, They don't turn out how... I can't predict how it's going to turn out. But I'm okay today. I've been okay. I got through 12 years of a responsible job, drunk, not working. I don't know how I did that. It was, But I made up for it. I actually had a pretty good career after I got sober in my last 15 years there. I am one of those people who I'm truly grateful that I'm an alcoholic, because without this program, I'd be right. Well, I'd be dead. A lot of us would be dead if we didn't get sober. But if I were alive by some mischance, I'd be the same miserable, mystified loner that I was the first half of my life. And I truly don't regret. It took me what it took me. You know, I think we all have pretty unique stories, but my story, you know, is tough. I don't regret. I don't regret my past because I had to go through everything that I went through to get where I am today. And I say this, and my wife elegantly says, "Oh, you're blowing sunshine up my ass." That I am better off today than I ever have been in my life. In self-acceptance, self-respect, the ability to relate to other people, to stay sober and to grow. And this program is unique, I think, in that we have the opportunity to, you know, I hope to continue to keep growing until the day they plant me, you know, and then I can grow someplace else. But, you know, that's the beauty of the program. It's bummies, you know, you carefully, you know, open the curtain, because if you open it all at once, you'd be just overwhelmed by the magnificence of the program. Because I tried everything. I tried talking to the priests. I talked to psychiatrists. I talked to friends. I tried drinking. I tried encounter groups. I tried everything. And never got a clue. Read all the self-help books. And, you know what they're worth? Nothing. But this program, I didn't even have a desire to stop drinking when I came in. I had a desire to get my drinking under control, and it still caught me. I'm forever grateful to AA, and what that means is that I'm grateful to everyone in this room who's, you know, I know most of you, and, you know, there's hundreds of people in the area that I'm intimately familiar with, and they're intimately familiar with me, and that's a miracle that we can stand up here and share the hope. You know, there is hope, and I'm very grateful that I am an alcoholic and that I found the program. It's the answer. So anyway, thank you. Thank you.